well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad to be with you on the program today. Not happy to be talking about our topic, the elections on Tuesday. As a resident of the Commonwealth of Virginia, I am steeling myself for a nightmare come the 2026 legislative session. Democrats in complete control of a state government with Abigail Spanberger winning handily on Tuesday night. And Democrats sweeping statewide elections in Virginia. And again, I mean, it wasn't even close. I'm looking here, the latest election results, I think this is with something like 98% of the votes in. Abigail Spanberger, 57.2%. Winsome Earl Sears, 42.6%. I mean, that is a drubbing. There's just no other word for it. And I don't want to do a whole postmortem today. You know, I was critical of Winsome Earl Sears' campaign during the campaign for not talking more about gun control. I still think that was a mistake for reasons that we'll get into a little bit later on in the program. But honestly, that wasn't the difference in this election. Even if Winsome Earl Sears had managed to get every gun owner in the state of Virginia to go out and vote for her, I suspect she still would have lost this election. I mean, based on that margin. We also saw passage of a red flag law in Maine via a ballot referendum. We'll talk about that a little bit later on in the program. New Jersey's governor race, thought it was going to be close between Jack Cittarelli and Mickey Sherrill. It was not. Again, about the same margin of victory as we saw for Spanberger in Virginia at the moment. Mickey Sherrill, 56.2% of the vote. Jack Cittarelli, 43.2% of the vote. And again, we had seen polls suggesting that these races were, well, at least the New Jersey governor's race was tighter, right? I mean, the polls in Virginia show Spanberger with a lead of anywhere between, you know, 7 to 12 points. And so those polls showing that, you know, 12-point victory, I think those are pretty darn close to accurate. There wasn't a lot of polling on the red flag referendum in Maine. There was one that was done in October that actually showed opponents narrowly in the lead, 40% disapprove, 38% approve of question two, but then 22% undecided. If that poll was anywhere close to accurate, then virtually all of those undecideds decided to vote for a red flag law. And some of those who oppose actually changed their mind too, because again, the red flag measure passing handily in the state of Maine. But I do want to drill down a little bit here into some of these elections. This is from the New York Times. The shift in the margin throughout the state of Virginia last night compared to last year in the presidential election. And you can see across the state, it wasn't just the already deep blue areas, although those became bluer, right? But even the reddest parts of Virginia shifted, in some cases, fairly substantially in favor of the Democrats. And you can look at some of the largest population centers in Virginia. And again, there was a noticeable shift, a shift of more than 10 points, for instance, in Fairfax County, where Spanberger won by 47 points. That was a 12-point shift from last year's elections. Chesterfield, which is a suburb of Richmond, Virginia, Spanberger by 17. That was a shift of about 8 points. 8-point shift in the favor of Democrats in Virginia Beach, where Spanberger won by 11. Loudoun County, which recently, as a couple of election cycles ago, was pretty competitive. Spanberger by 29. Another 12-point shift in favor of Democrats. Prince William County, Spanberger by 34. That was a 16-point shift in Spanberger's favor. Henrico County, another Richmond suburb, Spanberger by 38, a shift of almost 10 points in the direction of Democrats. But as I said, even when you get into the red parts of the state, there was a noticeable shift, not necessarily 12-point swings like we saw in Northern Virginia and in the Richmond area. But Lynchburg, Virginia, for instance, home of Liberty University, Spanberger actually won Lynchburg by a point. because Lynchburg swung about 9 points from the 2024 election towards Democrats' favor. Pennsylvania County's Elizabeth Rosero still won that by 41 points. She won Franklin County by 41 points. But there were shifts towards the Democrats, about 2 points in Pennsylvania County, 4 points in Franklin County. Campbell County, which is just outside, is the surrounding county outside of Lynchburg. 47-point win for Winsome Earl Sears, but about a 2-point shift towards Spanberger. Culpeper County, Winsome Earl Sears winning by 16, but again, a shift of about 7 points towards Winsome Earl Sears. Or, excuse me, towards Abigail Spanberger. There were only, I believe, 5 counties in Virginia where Winsome Earl Sears performed better than Donald Trump did last year. And even then, we're talking, you know, a point, maybe 2 points in that direction. So, you know, one of the keys to Winsome Earl Sears' victory was going to be keeping those margins that Glenn Youngkin saw in rural Virginia 4 years ago. And while she won those counties and still won pretty handily, Abigail Spanberger was able to make inroads. And, you know, that combined again with increased turnout and a decided shift towards Democrats in Northern Virginia and Richmond, the Virginia Beach area, really sank Winsome Earl Sears' campaign. So, as I said, I wish that she had been talking more about the threats to our Second Amendment rights on the campaign trail. That was pretty much absent from the campaign messaging that I saw and that I received. A lot of talk about Abigail Spanberger is for they, them, not for you. Clearly that didn't resonate. I don't know. Even if Winsome Earl Sears had run a strong Second Amendment campaign, I don't know that it would have been enough to save her and get her elected into office. But I do believe that not talking about the threats to our right to keep and bear arms is one of the reasons why we saw, even in conservative parts of the state, a swing towards Democrats. I don't know if this is gun owners not turning out. I don't know if this is gun owners believing that their rights are not going to be threatened. But either way, their rights are going to be threatened here. Just as a reminder, with Glenn Youngkin in the governor's office, but with Democrats in control of the state legislature in Virginia, they passed more than 24 gun control bills this year that were vetoed. As NRA's Institute for Legislative Action noted back in March of this year, the bills vetoed by Governor Youngkin came from the long wish list of radical gun control activists. This included attempts to restrict the constitutional rights of 18 to 20-year-old adults, dramatically expand gun-free zones that would have left law-abiding Virginians defenseless, enact a mandatory waiting period to take possession of a legally purchased firearm. In addition, the vetoed legislation would have banned a wide range of commonly owned firearms used by Virginians to hunt, compete, and for self-defense. All of those bills are coming back. All of those bills are coming back. You know, I wrote about this in Bearing Arms today. The one thing that might get Democrats to tap the brakes is concern about voter backlash 2 years from now when every seat in the state legislature is up for grabs. But I don't even know that that's going to be the case. It may actually encourage them to hit the gas. Let's pass all these gun control bills now, and then we can take a breather in 2027 when we're up for a re-election. And by then, the voters will have had time to, you know, digest and forget about what we did in 2026. So I expect an onslaught of gun control legislation here. The last time Democrats had complete control of the state government, they weakened preemption, they passed a red flag law, they imposed more gun-free zones. There was a ban on so-called assault weapons and large-capacity magazines that did not pass because 2 rural Democrat state senators objected. They no longer object to bans on so-called assault weapons and large-capacity magazines. In fact, Craig Deeds, one of the state senators who opposed a gun ban back in 2020, sponsored the so-called assault weapons ban this year. So I think we are going to see. Now, again, I don't know what the specifics are going to be. We may actually see competing gun control bills, right? One that is sort of the old-fashioned assault weapon ban based on features, maybe specific models. And then the newfangled gas-operated semi-automatic gun ban that's been introduced in Congress by Martin Heinrich of New Mexico, Angus King of Maine. This was the bill that was championed by New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham this year. Democrats in New Mexico didn't get behind that. But again, I would not be surprised if Democrats in Virginia do. I think we are looking at waiting periods. I think we are looking at restricting the rights of 18, 19, 20-year-olds to exercise their Second Amendment rights. I worry that we're looking at the complete repeal of firearms preemption and allowing anti-gun locales like Richmond, Fairfax County, Alexandria, Arlington to impose whatever local gun controls they want, creating this patchwork quilt of anti-gun ordinances across the Commonwealth. And I got to tell you, I mean, in Northern Virginia, if that happens, it's really difficult to know where you are sometimes. Are you in Fairfax County? Are you in an independent city like Falls Church? Have you crossed the border into Arlington? Are you in Alexandria? Are you in Fairfax County? It's not like these areas are clearly defined. So it's going to be real easy if preemption goes away for lawful gun owners to get tripped up and to suffer the consequences. We also need to talk about the Attorney General's office in Virginia. Jason Meares, the Republican Attorney General, defeated by Jay Jones, despite Jones's texts that were revealed in the final weeks of the campaign, showing him wishing death on then House Speaker Todd Gilbert, wondering if the murder of Todd Gilbert's children would convince Todd Gilbert to start supporting gun control. This is the guy who's now going to be the chief law enforcement officer for the state of Virginia. And whereas Jason Meares was supporting amicus briefs in support of our right to keep our arms, Jay Jones is going to be taking the lead on amicus briefs, encouraging infringements on our right to keep and bear arms. That's going to have an impact on gun owners too. New Jersey, I hate to say it, but it's kind of the status quo, right? You've had an anti-gun governor, you've had an anti-gun AG. That's going to remain the case, unfortunately. Virginia's a sea change. It really is. And I think we're going to see a couple of things. I suspect we're going to see Second Amendment Sanctuary 2.0 in the Commonwealth of Virginia. 5 years ago, when Democrats, well, 6 years ago, when Democrats took control of the state government after the 2019 elections, we saw, I think it was close to 100 of the 120 counties and independent cities in the state of Virginia adopt Second Amendment Sanctuary resolutions or ordinances. I think we're going to see another round of that. And I suspect this time around, there's going to be attempts to put some teeth behind those ordinances. We're not going to enforce these laws that we believe infringe on our right to keep and bear arms at the county level, at the local level. You can have them on the books, but we're going to use our discretion not to enforce these laws against peaceable citizens. I think that's coming. I suspect that after several years in which attendance at the Virginia Citizens Defense League's Lobby Day rally could be measured in the dozens, not even the hundreds, much less the tens of thousands that were on hand in January of 2020. I think we're going to see a return, maybe not 50,000, 60,000 people like we saw in 2020, but maybe. A lot depends, again, on what kind of bills get dropped by Democrats between now and Lobby Day in January of next year. But again, all of those are defensive moves. And they are coupled with litigation, fighting these gun control laws, essentially the only tools that we have in the toolbox for the next couple of years until we can organize and hopefully take back at least one or both of the legislative chambers that will be up for grabs in 2027. So if you are a Virginia gun owner, you're listening to the sound of my voice right now, you don't belong to the Virginia Citizens Defense League or the Virginia Shooting Sports Association, join, sign up, get involved, get active. If you are not a member of a national organization, whether it's NRA, GOA, FPC, SAF, excuse me, get involved. Sign up. Become a member. Donate if you can. Because the to borrow the phrase from the FPC, the lawsuit printer is going to go a lot in the Commonwealth of Virginia in the coming months. And these lawsuits are expensive. There are going to be a lot of them. We're going to need to file a lot of them, unfortunately. And so these groups are going to need our help as well. So that's Virginia. Let's talk about Maine for a second. well, for more than a second. Let's talk about Maine for a minute. This is again from the New York Times here. Question two, establishing a process for people to request extreme risk protection orders against individuals who are believed to be dangerous. These orders would prohibit those individuals from possessing firearms or other weapons for up to a year. And as of Wednesday morning, 63.4% of the voters in Maine approved question two. 36.6% saying no. Now, a couple of things. The yes on question two folks had a decided monetary advantage. No doubt about it. But 9 years ago, when a universal background check referendum was on the ballot in Maine, supporters of that measure had a decided monetary advantage too, and it was defeated by 52% of the electorate in Maine. So money does have an impact. It plays a role, but it's not everything. You had Governor Janet Mills opposing the red flag referendum, saying, let's stick with what we have in right now, the yellow flag law. But I think one of the things that really benefited the supporters of the red flag referendum is the fact that there was no competing measure on the ballot, right? If you wanted to do something in response to the shooting in Lewiston, this was your option, right? Stand pat with the yellow flag law or create a red flag law. Republicans in the legislature wanted to have a competing ballot measure that would have expanded, among other things, would have expanded access to mental health care, particularly in rural parts of the state. Democrats denied that effort. So there was no real, well, the choice was, again, stick with the status quo or do something. If there had been two options to do something, I suspect that the red flag measure would not have enjoyed the level of support that it did on Tuesday night. I think a big part of why we're seeing the sizable majority in favor of the red flag law is because, again, there is this impulse to, well, we just had this tragedy. We need to do something. This is the something that is available to do. So I'm going to vote yes. But again, you know, you look at the margins here. The most populated parts of the state, Portland, Oregon, 88%, or excuse me, Portland, Maine, 88% approving that red flag referendum. South Portland, 85% approval. Brunswick, Maine, 82% approval. Scarborough, Maine, 59% approval. Lewiston, Maine, 68% approval. Bangor, 69% approval. You've got to go way down into the rural counties of Maine to start to find opposition. And, you know, it's great when you've got a rural county that votes, you know, 80% opposed. But if there are 300 votes in that county, it doesn't make up for the fact that, you know, Portland, with 25,000 votes, almost 26,000 votes cast, supported the red flag referendum almost 9-1. Right. And again, if you look at the map, there were also parts of rural Maine that voted in favor of this red flag referendum. That October poll that I referenced earlier in the show indicated that about a third of Maine voters were unclear, admitted to being unclear about what the red flag law would do. About two-thirds of voters said that they felt like they had a pretty good understanding. I don't know that that's the case, honestly. I suspect that there are a lot of voters who are going to be very surprised to learn that there's no mental health component to this red flag law whatsoever. One of the ads that aired in support of question two involved, featured the father of somebody who was killed in Lewiston. And he talked about, I mean, again, so first of all, you've got this, you know, very emotional aspect to this ad, right? And he said, people who are having a mental health crisis need help, not easy access to guns. And he said, Maine's laws were too weak to save my son's life. Now, if you hear that, you think, okay, so if I vote for this red flag law, then somebody in a mental health crisis is going to get help. Well, no, they're not. Because there's no mental health component to the red flag statute that Maine voters approved on Tuesday. Not beforehand, right? Rather than a mental health professional making an evaluation, it's a judge who's going to determine whether or not somebody poses a danger to themselves or others. And if a judge says, yes, this individual does pose a danger to themselves or others, the state takes their guns away, prohibits them from legally purchasing more, and then leaves them alone. There's no mental health help that's offered. There's no mental health help that is required after a judge has deemed somebody to be a danger to themselves or others. There's no mental health component at all. The state of Maine considers the problem solved once that individual's guns are taken. Doesn't matter that they have access to knives, gasoline, matches, rope, a car, anything else that they could use to harm themselves or others. They don't have their guns. Problem solved. Again, I don't think that's what a lot of Maine voters actually thought they were voting for. When perhaps the most effective campaign ad certainly suggested that there was a mental health component to this measure. And there's simply not. So might we see some buyer's remorse in Maine? I think we will. But too late. I don't know that there's much that can be done about it. We may see a lawsuit filed, just as we've seen a lawsuit filed against the 72-hour waiting period that Democrats adopted as a response to the Lewiston shooting, even though it would not have had an impact on the Lewiston shooter. That law, by the way, has been enjoined right now. It's on hold, thanks to a federal judge. That case is on appeal to the First Circuit Court of Appeals. And we may see litigation against Maine's red flag law. I'll be honest with you. I think that's going to be an uphill fight. In Rahimi, the Supreme Court said that people can be temporarily disarmed of firearms if a court deems them to be dangerous. And that wasn't a red flag case that dealt with a domestic violence restraining order. But gun control activists are going to use that position of the Supreme Court to say, look, this is another case of a judge deeming somebody to be dangerous. We're temporarily removing their firearms. They can get their guns back after they demonstrate they're no longer a danger to themselves or others. You upheld essentially the same system in Rahimi. You should uphold it in this case, too. And I don't know that the court is going to object to that, honestly. So those fights are coming, but relief, if any, is to be found, is also, I think, likely a long time away. So again, bottom line, terrible night for gun owners. Absolutely terrible. I can't even find a silver lining, honestly. And I'm one who's an eternal optimist. I can generally find a pony, no matter how much manure is in the stable. This time around, nope. As a Virginian, I am terribly concerned that this time next year, my state, which has decent gun laws, is going to look a lot more like California, New York, New Jersey, than it does today. In Maine, the yellow flag law is going to remain on the books, but let's look and see in the first 12 months of the red flag law and the yellow flag law are both in place, how many yellow flag petitions are filed versus how many red flag petitions are filed. I think the yellow flag law is going to become essentially worthless. I mean, why go through the extra steps of seeking the guidance and the evaluation of a mental health professional when you don't have to? Why go through those additional steps that guarantee due process to the subject of a petition when you don't have to? And the yellow flag law required law enforcement to actually file that petition. The red flag law allows for family members to file instead of law enforcement. So the yellow flag law is not even an option for them. If they believe that somebody in their family is dangerous, they can't avail themselves of the yellow flag law unless they go to police. And again, why would you do that? If you're really concerned about somebody being a danger to themselves or others, why wouldn't you just immediately file that petition yourself? So, I always like to try to end on an optimistic note here, but I confess I am struggling today. Instead, I guess, again, my advice, it's the same advice I gave gun owners in Virginia. Get engaged, get involved, join your state groups, join your national groups supporting the right to keep and bear arms, because if yesterday was a canary in the coal mine for the midterms, I mean, we're in some serious, serious danger here. Not just at the congressional level. Again, the president could serve as a bulwark against any anti-gun legislation that Congress might pass if Democrats take control of Congress. But we could see state legislatures flip. We could see pro-gun governors replaced by anti-gun governors. The Second Amendment landscape could change dramatically next November, just like it changed dramatically in the state of Virginia on Tuesday. All right, let us turn our attention now to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report, which comes to us from California. Court watch, man released on own recognizance despite prosecution's objections. It's from the Davis Vanguard case out of Woodland, California, where a man was released on supervised own recognizance despite the prosecution's argument to keep him in custody after multiple parole violations. As the Vanguard reports, the decision came after the defense argued that the man was originally given a lengthy prison sentence for a violation committed at age 16, asserting that the system failed to rehabilitate him. Oh, it's the system's fault. Deputy District Attorney Alvina Zhang stated that the man was sentenced to 14 years in prison in 2013 for robbery and dissuasion of a witness, basically witness intimidation. Did 10 years of that 14-year sentence, which is actually pretty good for California. Shortly after he got out in July of 2023, he racked up his first parole violation within a month for possession of a knife. Zhang said, according to my records, he has a total of 13 violations since he was released from prison. Most recent violation occurred in March of 2025, leaving his county of residence for more than 48 hours without notifying his parole or getting his parole agent's permission. Possession of drug paraphernalia, unauthorized possession of a knife, possession of a, was described as an assimilated firearm. I don't know what that is. Maybe a facsimile firearm? Prosecution argued that based on the nature of his violations, the people believe that he continues to pose a public safety risk. She acknowledged that his current case involves, quote, only a felony petty theft offense. How do you have felony petty theft? Anyway, but she said she was not confident that he would comply with probation terms if released. Meanwhile, his public defender said that the man's sentencing took place in 2013 before Prop 57 was passed, that that light on crime measure that I don't think would pass today in California. And said, quote, for some reason, he was given a 14-year prison sentence as a 16-year-old. I'm guessing because of the severity of his crime. I'm guessing that's the reason. He said, while robbery and dissuasion of a witness are serious charges, quote, for a 16-year-old to be sent to prison with a 14-year prison sentence, which he spent 10 years in prison for, the system didn't do a very good job of trying to rehabilitate this man. Well, no. Maybe they didn't. But if this 16-year-old was sentenced to adult prison, then rehabilitation wasn't necessarily the primary goal, as it is in the juvenile justice system. But also, what did this individual do to rehabilitate himself? Did the system try? Did the system offer this individual opportunities to turn his life around? And did this individual take advantage of those opportunities? Doesn't sound like it. The public defender also disputed the prosecution's claims about parole violations, saying Ms. Zhang is listing 1,000 parole violations. I'm not sure how many of those were sustained violations. I saw a case in his file the other day. It was dismissed. Again, presumably because there was no proof that he committed the offense. Regardless, guy's out on his own recognizance, not even required to post bond. He is supposed to report to probation weekly and follow all of the release guidelines, which he is accused of not doing repeatedly since he's been released from prison without any consequence. So why he would abide by these terms, I have no idea. But that was the decision by the judge in California. On to today's armed citizen story from Tulsa, Oklahoma, where a person was shot and killed after an apparent home break-in. This was last Friday on a Halloween, just before midnight. Officers responded to a shooting in an apartment complex. A caller reported that they had heard about 20 gunshots and then saw a man on the ground with a firearm next to him. When officers arrived, they found 20-year-old Jamon Silas deceased in front of the door of an apartment. On the scene, a man came forward and said he was the one who shot Silas. The man said he was inside the apartment when Silas kicked in the door and entered his domicile, and the man said that he shot Silas in self-defense. The man questioned by police, released pending further investigation. Haven't heard any updates from that, so at the moment it appears that the evidence matches the armed citizens recounting of the events in question. We'll keep our eyes open for any more details, but right now this does look to be a justifiable use of lethal force. And finally today, our good deed of the day. In the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing, a fisherman on the shores of Lake Superior who, quote, more than likely saved the life of a woman who was swept in to the chilly waters of the lake. This happened Sunday afternoon. The woman was there with three fellow campers, and they were on their way to a lighthouse on the shores of Lake Superior near Duluth when, I guess, there was a big wave washed her into the harbor there. According to authorities, the 21-year-old woman was in the water for 3 to 4 minutes before she was back on shore. While she was in the water, she was trying to make her way back. She was struggling, though. A 29-year-old fisherman from Duluth first called 911 and then used his 20-foot-long pole net to get to the woman and actually pull her the rest of the way. Deputy William Sandstrom, who responded to the emergency, said in his report that he thanked the fisherman and informed them that he more than likely saved her life. Minnesota Star Tribune says it reached out to the woman for her account of her bone-chilling experience. Her brother said Riley that she can be reached by phone, quote, once she recovers her phone from Lake Superior. Yeah. Well, again, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Temperatures at lake in the lake, by the way, about 40 degrees at that point. So it does not take long in that chilly water to develop hypothermia, to lose the ability to keep yourself afloat. So this really, when the officer said more than likely saved this woman's life, I think that is more than likely the case. So again, this anonymous Good Samaritan, don't know his name, but again, do know that if it were not for his actions, 21-year-old might very well have lost her life. We thank you, anonymous good citizen, for your very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Cam & Company. I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. I was going to say, if you like what you hear, but there's not much good news today. If you appreciate the coverage of Second Amendment news and information that we provide to you, I would encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. While the federal shutdown is underway, we've got a great promotion for you. Use the promo code POTUS47. And you can get 74% off your VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum membership. There are rumors that the shutdown is not going to last much longer. So I would take advantage of that while you can. And just a programming note, I'm going to be off tomorrow. Normally we do shows Monday through Thursday, but I am going to be out Thursday and Friday. So there will be no Cam & Company until next Monday. But we've already got a great group of guests for you next week. I'm not going to give any previews, but I've been busy booking. And I think you're going to like hearing from some fresh faces, new voices, as well as some old friends as well. But be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the rest of the week, over the weekend. Tom Knighton and the crew will be keeping you up to date on everything going on with your right to keep and bear arms. And again, I thank you so much for being a part of today's program. Until we talk again, be well, be safe, and try. Try to be as free as you can.